أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.
All together, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, parte la tappa numero 1 del Giro d'Italia.
Questo è il Giro d'Italia.
What was the instructions this morning from the team?
Exactly what you saw on TV.
Must be nice when a plan comes together.
It is, yeah, it's very nice. I'm, speechless, very nice, yeah.
Speechless, thank you very much.
You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2025 Giro d'Italia, celebrating 10 years of the cycling podcast on the ground, every day at the Giro d'Italia. Today we are in Tirana.
Cozze cittene, cozze, cozze vicine, nuspicudeci cora, nuspicudeci cora. Cozze cittene, cozze, cozze vicine, nuspicudeci cora, se lo mangiano le femmine.
Pershendetcha.
And to you, Daniel. And to you.
Hello. It's not good evening. I think it's just hello. Lionel, I'm not going to... Traditionally, we're going to start these episodes. We'll probably start many of these episodes with the immortal question. Where are we? But tonight, we have already heard from one of the protagonists in today's stage. Well, who was that, first of all?
That was Lidl Trek rider Søren Kragh Andersen, who, along with all of his teammates, played an instrumental role in setting up the stage win for their teammate and team leader, Mads Pedersen.
And, Lionel, we also heard, before that, I believe, the call to prayer in Durres last night. Now, we talked a lot about Albania in our pre-Giro episodes. One thing we didn't talk too much about was the religious hybridity, if that's a word, of Albania. The fact that Muslims and Christians live and have lived very harmoniously together and very equally split for a long time. About 50% of the population, in fact, it's just dipped below 50%, is Muslim, and 50% is predominantly Catholic, I think. But we heard that very evocative call to prayer, didn't we, in Durres last night.
And then we heard the very evocative call to prayer, if you can call it that, at the start this morning in Durres, the countdown to the start of the 2025 Giro d'Italia.
We're going to talk about what happened this morning and who we spoke to this morning in just a moment, Lionel, but you said it was evocative at the start. What would be your sort of snap assessment of the ambiance in Durres this morning?
At the start line, it was high spirits, really. There was quite a large crowd concentrated around the very start, but if you went a little bit further afield, it was quite quiet. There wasn't a huge crowd around the team buses, for example, and it was about the right size of crowd for the location, I would say.
It was quiet, quite quiet. I thought the crowds were quite big just outside the start area. One thing with taking a bike race to areas where there isn't a big culture of professional bike races is people don't really know where to stand. They don't know whether the best place is the buses or the start. And it seemed to me a consensus had sort of developed that the best place was just at the side of the road. And they weren't loud, were they? There was a lot of polite applause. And one phenomenon you certainly see at bike races, rock concerts, whatever nowadays, is that pretty much everyone is filming.
That's right, yes. Everyone had their mobile phone in the air filming the start. But having said that, it was a very friendly atmosphere, I felt. I mean, I got asked a lot of questions with my accreditation badge around my neck. I think people thought I'd organised the whole thing because they were asking, where did it start? Where do they go? What time did it start? Where is it tomorrow?
Watch out. Maravegna, watch out. I think he's retiring at the end of this year. You could be the next incumbent.
No chance.
Well, that was the atmosphere, Lionel. Now, we had our first episode of sorts, didn't we, last night? That was on, we posted that on Substack. It was a sort of Giro Eve scene setup. We referenced a couple of things in that. We're going to talk, before we talk about what happened in the stage, we're going to talk about this morning quickly. We had a few sort of loose ends to tie up or a few things to follow up on. Yesterday in that episode, we talked about Matt White unceremoniously leaving Jayco Alula. We wondered whether the riders would comment on that this morning. So I summoned Luke Plapp to the mix zone to see if he would tell us any more about why Matt White has left. Jake Alula, here's what he said.
Yeah, I think it came a bit of a surprise to all of us, but it's all above my pay grade, so I can't say much more than that.
No dice, Lionel. No dice on
that
front.
I mean, it wasn't
front.
Exactly Frost-Nixon, that, was it? That
well,
exchange.
It, no, it wasn't. It wasn't, but that's not what people come to the cycling podcast for. So that was that. Not settled. Not settled. We'll have a bit more time to investigate, I think, tomorrow, because everyone will be in one place for the time trial all day. So maybe we will Frost-Nixon them tomorrow. But lots of burning questions. That was one, the Matt White question, which, as I say, we'll follow up on. Lots of questions about this Giro and the favourites at this Giro. Primoz Roglic and Juan Ayuso, most people have named as their favourites. Two questions that have arisen in the last few days concerning those two. Primoz Roglic's coach, I think we mentioned this last night as well, maybe in the scene setter. Primoz Roglic's coach has said that the Giro d'Italia is not his main priority this year. It's the Tour de France. So we're going to hear me asking Primoz Roglic about that. And we're also going to hear on the Ayuso UAE question, we're going to hear Adam Yates. Who is the real leader, or who was, as of this morning, the real leader of UAE? Was it Adam Yates? Was it Juan Ayuso? Was it someone else? Let's hear Primoz Roglic and Adam Yates.
Everyone's going to ask you the same question. Are you the leader? Are you the joint leader? Is Juan the leader?
I think we've got seven leaders, to be honest. I mean, everyone's going good. Everyone's been training real well, and we've been up in Sierra Nevada, you know, working hard. So the whole team's at a super high level, and I think we can use that to our advantage. Maybe we don't have the big favourite, but we got, you know, a lot of guys in that kind of second group that that maybe we can use to our advantage. But I think we just have to be smart, take our time, and be patient, and see how the race pans out.
Primoz, your coach said the Tour is a bigger priority than the Giro. Do you feel the same?
I mean, you know, like, it's just unfair. I mean, yeah, like, I don't even want to think about it now, about the Tour. Yeah, I'm just starting the Giro. I am now here, yes, 21 days to go. And I will definitely try to do my best here, and then, yes, we see what and how it follows next ones.
So that's absolutely nothing settled, Lionel.
Well, we've got
some
20 more days to
settle. Prime journalism
this
morning.
We've got a whole race.
Nothing found
to settle
out.
This. Come on. It was a big day for Q36.5 and Doug Ryder, the team boss, especially. Their first Grand Tour. They come here with Tom Pidcock and Doug Ryder's been in this situation before, of course, with the MTN Quebeca team. 11 years ago, they made their Grand Tour debut at the Vuelta a España. But I saw him at the team buses this morning and asked him how he was feeling just as they were getting ready to roll out for their first Grand Tour. And crucially, what would a gold standard Giro d'Italia for Q36.5 and Tom Pidcock look like?
No, I mean, gold for sure would be a stage win or two and a top five on the general classification. I mean, that would be way out there, you know, dream goal for this team. So, and then, everything from there, you know, is you know, underneath that would be still successful. Like a stage win would be massive. I mean, as you know, 23 teams fighting for 21 stages. You know, people don't realize how, you know, you got eight riders in a team, you know, all wanting to at least try and win a stage, but the numbers don't play up, you know, so it's not so easy. So yeah, and then there's some teams that win a few.
How important is it then to have a team where you've got an option every day, which you clearly have?
No, it's critically important. Unless you're going solely for the general classification, then you need a group of riders that can survive in different facets of a day and look after the leader and not lose time and take your opportunities. We're not that team. What I love about Tom in his role and his function in this team as a leader, he never ever wants to see on the board of the race like, you know, let's save time today, or let's not lose time. So that's, you know, we want to take every opportunity into race as much as we can at the highest level on every day and give our riders a chance to succeed on every day with strategic intent, you know, not cowboy style, but, and we've always done that in the past. I mean, if you look at Steve Cummings in the Tour de France, if you look at our last Giro d'Italia in 2021, Mauro Schmidt, Victor Campenaerts, and Giacomo Nizzolo won three stages in three different ways on three different courses with a proper strategic plan around it and support. I mean, so that's kind of the way we approach things, which is quite exciting.
Well, that was a lot of scene setting, wasn't it, Lionel? I feel like the tension, the suspense, you could cut the suspense with a very blunt instrument before the Processo alla Tappa. For those who don't know what happened in today's stage, they're wondering about Roglic, they're wondering about Yates, they're wondering about Pidcock. I suppose now is the time to ask what did happen in today's stage in the first Processo alla Tappa, the first post-stage inquisition of this Giro d'Italia.
Il Processo alla Tappa, the post-stage inquisition.
So Lionel, very simple question for you. What happened?
What happened? Well, it was stage one, wasn't it, from Durres to Tirana. Not particularly long, 160 kilometres. The first break was five riders, the first significant break. They got away, got a bit of a gap. Alessandro Verde of Arkea, Sylvain Moniquet of Cofidis, Taco van der Hoorn of Intermarché, and Alessandro Tornelli of Pulci.
He of the 1,300-something kilometres of breakaways in San Remo over... This year he didn't participate, but the previous 5 years.
And Manuele Tarozzi of VF Group Bardiani. And they didn't get much of a lead, really, all day. But they were still away over the big climb. The first real incident of this Giro d'Italia was a crash for Juan Ayuso as they approached that second category climb with around 90 kilometres to go. He changed his bike and got back on simply enough. Taco van der Hoorn was first to get dropped from the brake on that second category climb, and there was a period where the brake split up a bit. Verre was ahead on his own for a while, but they all came back together for the key moment of the entire day, the Red Bull kilometre. Oh. What a moment it was. Game-changing, apparently. The four riders were still only about 35 seconds clear at this point, and Manuele Tarozzi goes down in Giro history as the first winner of the Red Bull kilometre. Wow. It was gripping stuff, that, wasn't it?
I think I might have gone down in history for being the first Giro journalist to taste the forest fruit sugar-free Red Bull.
What was the verdict?
It was bestowed upon us in the press room. I don't like Red Bull. I don't like energy drinks generally, and this was pretty bad as well, but at least no sugar. It was vaguely, vaguely palatable.
This whole competition is going to be sponsored by somebody else.
We will never be sponsored by Red Bull. No.
Anyway, then they were coming to the finish circuit. They were going to do two laps of this circuit featuring the Suril climb, which had a pretty steep section on it towards the bottom part of the climb. With 40 kilometres to go, that was when the break was finally caught. Lidl Trek and Visma Lisebike were the teams most prominent on the front of the peloton, but Lidl Trek were really doing most of the driving. The first sprinters to be dropped were Sam Bennett and Olaf Kooi, and the second time up the climb is when Lidl Trek really applied the pressure, didn't they? And they had a very clear plan of what to do. Carlos Verona rode for a long time and then handed over to Giulio Ciccone, who is a podium contender for this Giro d'Italia, and there he was setting at a fierce pace. There were some significant riders in difficulty here as well, because Timon Arensman of Ineos Grenadiers was dropped at this point around a kilometre from the top, and as they approached the top with maybe 200-300 metres to go, Wout van Aert of Visma Lisebike was slipping back a little bit. There'd been all this talk in the lead up to the race about him being unwell and on antibiotics. So perhaps that explained
how many wheels was he back? About 20, 25 wheels? And there was just a hint of a split there. I actually thought, we will talk about this more in the second part, because this was the key moment of the day, but I actually thought that Ciccone had set it up. He tenderised Mads Pedersen for a GC attack. I saw Roglic on his radio about 500 metres to go to the top, and I thought, we might get a bit of a Roglification here.
Well, on the descent, it was a tricky descent actually, and one rider came to grief. Mikel Landa slipped out with around 5 kilometres to go on a sweeping left-hand bend. It didn't look all that difficult, but they got it wrong, and Landa went over the edge and down quite a drop as well. He is actually out of the race. He didn't make it to the finish. And then we came into the sprint, and it was Mads Pedersen of Lidl Trek who just about held on. Wout van Aert had ridden himself right back into contention, was involved in the sprint, and maybe if it had been another 50 or 100 metres down that finish straight, he might have just got in front of Pedersen. But no, Mads Pedersen held on to win the opening stage of the Giro d'Italia and take the first pink jersey ahead of Wout van Aert. Third was Olaus Aula of Movistar. Fourth was Francesco Buzzato of Antomarché in his first Grand Tour. Fifth, Thomas Pidcock. Thomas, very formal. I'm reading the official results here. It's like Tom Pidcock. Sixth, Diego Ulissi. Seventh, Richard Carapaz. Eighth, Max Poole. Ninth, Nicola Conchi. And tenth, Davide Piganzoli of Polti Visit Malta.
Did a few riders, any GC riders lose time?
Like a few did, Daniel, yes. Derek G and Louis Menkes and Danny Martinez were in a group at 57 seconds. I mean, Danny Martinez is riding in support of Primoz Roglic primarily, I guess, but still a bit of lost time there. Tymon Arensman in the end conceded 1 minute 35. And then Jay Vine of UAE Team Emirates, 3 minutes 59
who crashed
lost.
Who came down in the Lander crash. Should also mention Geoffrey Bouchard, who is a DNF, unfortunately, like Mikael Lander tonight. He came down in the same crash, which it's always, well, it's maybe facile, easy to point the finger of blame when riders, when the peloton has been over a climb and been down a descent before, which they had. They obviously knew the course, they knew what was coming. We didn't see the crash itself, so we don't know exactly what had happened, but they obviously slipped out on a bend, didn't they?
Yeah, and Pau Bilbao was even further back than Jay Vine, 5:35. Not entirely sure what had happened to him. But yeah, one rider out already at this stage, and that is Mikael Lander, who of course has been on the podium at the Giro twice before. He's also a former King of the Mountains winner here, and he's won a couple of stages over the years. So Sudal Quickstep have lost their big GC hope already.
They have also, Lionel, well, they'll also be, I think, a bit concerned, and I'm a bit concerned on behalf of Ethan Hayter, who has been really out of sorts, and we will endeavour over the next few weeks to find out exactly how things are going for him at Sudal Quickstep, because he is a rider who, if you sort of wind the clock back a couple of years, would have been ideally suited to a stage like today's, and he came in a long way down. I don't know whether that was because he just hung around to see if he could help Mikael Lander or whether he was with Luke Lamperti. However, Lionel, the jerseys, who's wearing them?
Well, Mads Pedersen is in pink, of course. He also leads the points competition, but Wout van Aert will wear that jersey tomorrow because he's in second place. Sylvain Moniquet from the break is in the King of the Mountains jersey. And Francesco Buzzato, as I said, in his first Giro, will be in the white young riders jersey. Daniel, who did you speak to at the finish? Because we dashed down to the finish line. All the riders were coming over, getting their drinks from the soigneurs. You were in there with your microphone. Who were you talking to?
I, Lionel, today after the finish, spoke to one of the Little Trek riders who was very, very instrumental in that Mads Pedersen win. You've already mentioned him. It's Carlos Verona. Well, Carlos, what a start and what a job by you on that last climb. Just tell us, well, what was the instruction this morning? How were you supposed to ride? Were you looking at watts? Was it Mads telling you how fast to ride? How did you do it?
By feeling. At the end, you cannot look into the watts because depending on the climb, the feeling is completely different. The goal was to listen to Mads. Mads was like feeling super strong. And yeah, I think all the team commit to that. I think also Mads is really nice leader to work for. He's super, like, always motivating the teammates. And yeah, it's super nice to start a Giro like this.
So go until you blow, and then Giulio came in and he did his turn. Was that the plan, or did you have in your mind, I want to do 2 kilometers of that climb, then he does the last two?
No, they told me, put a tempo, you can go to the end of the climb, just in case, you know, he was not feeling super, but he was feeling really good. So then, yes, Giulio took over, and I think I didn't see it anymore because I stood up. But I think they did it pretty strong. And I hear in the radio there were not many guys left in the top of the climb. And then, yeah, Mats was super confident. I think he had this day in his agenda since the beginning of the season. And I'm super happy for him, and also super happy to be here in this team to try to put my part for him and also for Chico when the mountains come, no?
I think he can keep it the essay for sure. Mats is super strong. If he is motivated and in a course like it tomorrow, I hope he can make it and we can have the Maria Rosa for a few days.
We haven't seen you in Italy too many times, but we're not in Italy yet. So what were your first impressions of Albania today, and what were the conditions like out there, the crowds?
Yeah, it's like quite nice. I think I really like when the Grand Tours start outside from the original country. I think it's a way also to span cycling, to get closer to other fans. And so far, Albania has been so nice to us. We have still 2 more days here. Yeah, it's a new country. Still, I think there is not a lot of cycling culture, but let's hope after this year there is more and more people getting into bikes here.
Want to access an archive of more than 300 Friends of the Podcast episodes and new Kilometer Zero and Kilometer Zero Live episodes dropping throughout the season, all while supporting the cycling podcast's on-the-ground coverage of the major tours? Go to thecyclingpodcast.com for information on how to sign up for as little as £35 a year.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Well, Lionel, we heard there from Carlos Verona talking about the plan, the perfect plan that Søren Krogh Andersen had referenced earlier in the episode, how that all came together. And as far as a first stage of a Giro d'Italia, first stage of a Grand Tour, I think it came together as far as the spectators are concerned, as far as RCS, the organisers are concerned. I think we had a really exciting finale, the kind of finale that they would have hoped for, Mara Venue would have hoped for when designing this interesting first stage with that climb, that third category climb to be repeated, to be ridden twice in the finale. It reminded me a little bit of last year's first stage in Turin, which was won by Jonathan Narvaez, was it not? Ahead of Tadej, or ahead of Max Schachmann, actually, and then Tadej Pogacar. But Little Trek always impressed me with the extent to which they commit to Mads Pedersen, and I think this has a lot to do with Mads Pedersen himself and his sort of charisma as a leader. I think that he's the one very often who is making sure they all commit.
Well, yeah, I mean, if it hadn't been for Tadej Pogacar, another euro in the fine jar for mentioning Tadej Pogacar when he's not riding, and Matthew van der Poel, Mads Pedersen would have been the man of the spring. His results were absolutely extraordinary. I mean, rarely out of the top half dozen places. And as you say, Lidl Trek completely committed from a long way out. They were really in control of things on the penultimate climb and the final climb, and they didn't let up. And it wasn't just commitment from, you know, the domestiques, the support riders. They wheeled out Giulio Ciccone to keep that pace incredibly high as they came to the top of the climb. Because although it was quite a long way down the descent and the run-in, it was still the possibility that GC riders might try something there, or splits could open, or it could all get, you know, a little bit out of control. And this was one of the things that Mads Pedersen talked about in the press conference afterwards, that they wanted to make it really hard at the top of the climb, which is why when Ciccone took over and set that really hard pace, they were very aware that Roglic was sitting three or four wheels back. Now Roglic was probably sitting there just to be alert, not necessarily to make a move, but Lidl Trek wanted to make sure that nothing sort of wild happened on the run-in. I asked Mads Pedersen in that press conference whether he was aware that Wout van Aert had slipped back in that final 300-400 metres of that final climb, and he said that the director sportif was on the radio to let the riders know that van Aert was struggling a bit, he was losing a bit of ground, but they were also very aware that he's a very smart rider, and van Aert had started the climb in a great position, had ridden more or less all the way to the top right near the front, perhaps had given himself just a little bit of slippage room so that he could recover a bit on the descent. So they weren't thinking, oh great, we've got him. They weren't ruling him out as a real life threat in the sprint. Mads Pedersen delighted to win the stage, it goes without saying. I mean, he said the classics are where his heart lies, but when you get a jersey like this, meaning the Maglia Rosa, it's also very special.
Did he get some indestructible boxer shorts?
No, I have a bit more dignity than to ask people about their underwear in press conferences.
This is what we want, Daniel, to know. We talked about this in the, was it the preview episode? Yuman, the new sponsor of the Maglia Rosa, they make a boxer short, apparently. We're not in Italy yet, so we haven't been able to buy any for ourselves yet, but apparently they make a boxer short called the Indestructible.
I don't know how long you've been following cycling, Daniel, but the riders don't wear any underpants under their cycling shorts. I don't know if this this is news to you.
What was the other question you asked, Pedro?
Well, I just asked, he was kind of asked what's next in the Giro. You know, there's this assumption, isn't there? You get one win and the pressure's off. I mean, he gave completely the opposite impression, really. He said when they've started with a win, they can't sit back and enjoy the next 20 days. For a start, they have Ciccone, who is a good outside bet for the podium, I would say.
Really? No. How many peers have you had?
Top five?
Maybe top five.
Top five.
Outside chance. Look at his past record as a GC rider. Not good.
Well, he's coming here to try and ride GC, right?
Yes, but look at his... Anyone can say that they're coming here to ride GC, but if they have no pedigree, then I'm not going to have a whole lot of confidence in that. I think he'll definitely win this. I think he's got a great chance of winning a stage.
I'll tell you what, Laurent Fignon had no pedigree when he won the Tour de France in 1983. Anyway, they are going to target more stage wins. Mads Pedersen won in Napoli a couple of years ago, didn't he? Quite a different finish.
Yes.
This year's stage is very different. All the climbing is in the first half and it's kind of a downhill and then flat running. But it's also long, 227 kilometres that day. I did ask whether he had his eyes on that stage. He said in typical Grand Tour press conference style that they were taking it day by day. They would look at each day as it comes. But he said, if you're telling me it suits me, I'll definitely have my eye on it. So they're off to a flyer there.
Yes.
And Giulio Ciccone is the Giro champion in waiting.
You mentioned Laurent Fignon. How old was Laurent Fignon in 1983? Giulio Ciccone is past 30, Lionel, I think. He is past 30.
Young man.
I'm just looking at stage 3. I think stage 3 is probably going to be too difficult for Mads Pedersen. Although I have seen Little Trek commit on stages like that before. I remember one at the Vuelta a couple of years ago, which he didn't ultimately win. But as I say, they go all in. They tend to when he's riding. Should we talk about Van Aert just for a moment? You talked there about Pedersen referring to his direct sportif. I think that was Maxime Montfort, the Belgian former rider who was in the team car, and they are not coming. They think Van Aert's been sandbagging coming into this Giro d'Italia. We know that he's been ill. He said he wasn't on top form. And well, it was interesting today. Visma Lisa bike, they worked in the first part of the stage. Why did they work? Well, Van Aert or the team told some of our colleagues at the finish that that was because they didn't want Little Trek to feel as though they were having to do everything, and they didn't want a sort of standoff to develop with them. Those are teams that are probably going to have to work together quite a lot on various stages, so it was sort of in the name of that. But it was interesting that today was clearly not an Olaf Kooi stage for them. Kooi was getting dropped already on the Gratzen climb, and they didn't really, well, they didn't show any concern. Simon Yates looked strong today. He's a bit of a mystery, he's a bit of a question mark going into this Giro, but he was very much on his own, doing his own thing on that final climb. And Van Aert, at a certain point, was doing his own thing as well. But he's clearly in decent form. Reminded me a little bit today of the first stage of the Tour de France last year, when, of course, he was coming back from that crash at Oiseldorf-Londres, and he actually broke down in tears after the finish that day in, where were we, Rimini. Because it had been such an ordeal to get back. Obviously, you know, we're only talking about a short illness on this occasion, but a reassuring day, I would suggest, for Van Aert fans.
Yeah, especially with the time trial tomorrow. I mean, it's going to be difficult because it's only short, isn't it? 13.7 kilometres. But it's not like it's not out of the question that he could have a good result there and still have a shot at the pink jersey. I mean, you say the third stage too hard for Mads Pedersen. Does that automatically make it too hard for Wout van Aert?
Yeah, I mean, what is it? Let's look ahead. I think I had it. I'll just find it. I think it's 12 kilometres at 7%.
Okay.
We're, you know, sort of 30 kilometres from the finish. These are very approximate figures. Fag packet figures. Yes, we shall say. I would suggest that will be more of a GC day. That's certainly just listening to GC riders talk about that third stage. I think they expect riders like Van Aert and Pedersen to be dropped on the final climb that day. Lionel, we talked in the first part about GC riders who had lost time today. We suspected there probably would be. There generally are on hilly first days of Grand Tours, and indeed there were for various reasons today. Mikel Landa is obviously the biggest victim. the consequences of his bad day are the worst. He's DNF'd because of that crash. We talked about it already. We could at this point launch into a long sort of paean to Landismo and the various misfortunes that have befallen him throughout his career. Unfortunately, this adds to the catalogue of those. Timon Arensman is an interesting one. 1 minute 35 seconds behind. Now, he had that great Tour of the Alps, or that great day in the Tour of the Alps in April, the end of April, just a couple of weeks ago, and he lost 1 minute 35. Now, he has a history of starting Grand Tours badly, and also of suffering. I was talking to our colleague Hans Rugenberg of the Telegraph this morning. Timon Arensman has suffered in the heat in the past.
It wasn't that hot today.
Well, that was what I was about to say. It really wasn't that hot.
I mean, I have caught the sun a bit. I suddenly think Giulio Ciccone is the second coming of Marco Pantani, but
yeah, 1 minute 35 though is a fairly serious deficit. Jay Vine again came down in that crash with Lander, 3 minutes 59. Now, that is a bit of a blow for UAE because people had speculated. We heard Adam Yates talk about the various options that team has. There had been speculation about them using Jay Vine on one of the early hilly stages, maybe a stage like stage three, to sort of bait some of the other GC teams. That might be more difficult now with him 4 minutes down. Dani Martinez, I guess there was people speculating about whether he might be a second deputy Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe leader. He lost time. How much did he lose?
He was in the group that lost 57 seconds, so not catastrophic.
And Derek G, who is definitely the Israel Premier Tech leader, and he lost 57 seconds as well. Some guys just take a while, don't they, to grow into a Grand Tour. It can be as simple as that.
Especially as it was pretty intense on that climb, wasn't it? The pace was on right from the start. It had been on from the penultimate climb anyway. And, you know, being on the limit, the concentration, it's easy to lose wheels. And a small gap at the top of a climb like that can become quite a big gap on the way down. Because there isn't, at the front of the race, is the impetus for everyone to get down. They're racing full on. But if you're in a group that's second or third over the top, and there's not the same level of desperation to get back up to the front. And so GC riders who find themselves in that company often are just, well, there's nothing they can really do unless they go to the front and drive it all on their own. They're kind of just sat there,
just mincing about.
But if you're in a group of 10, 15, 20 riders, none of whom are really that bothered about losing 57 seconds, it's a real problem if you are bothered about losing 57 seconds.
Yeah, indeed. Lionel, I was looking closely at that. Well, sort of 15 riders that almost kind of detached themselves at the top of the final climb, and a lot of GC guys in amongst them, a lot of deputy GC leaders, the likes of Jai Hindley. You maybe got a bit of a sense today of who is coming to this Giro really al dente and who has not. I have speculated, maybe I did yesterday in our scene setter, about UAE and how united they are around Juan Ayuso. He was one of the GC riders who was not particularly well positioned for a lot of that final climb and looked a little bit isolated at times. I mentioned Simon Yates. I thought he looked good. Carapaz was near the front for most of that climb. Roglic, I said, looked good as well. But Ayuso, I don't know. Maybe a small concern. Storachar looked great. We'll hear more about him later in the podcast from Larry.
Yeah, I think the thing about stages like this, especially right off the bat, the first bit of action in the Giro d'Italia, it suits the real GC mountain climbers least well. You know, they want consistency. They want a long climb. They want to get, you know, 3, 4, 5 kilometres of climbing at a fast pace in a, you know, strong rhythm, just to, I guess, get things going. Whereas if it's a short, sharp, classic style effort, I mean, we've seen Juan Ayuso climb very well on these kind of finishes. You know, he won Trofeo Liguria on very similar types of roads a couple of months ago. So it's not like he can't do it, but, and he was in there. He hadn't lost any time, of course, but it's just that sort of shock to the system, I guess. And the sort of the mental thing of this is day one of 21, so it's just about staying in the wheels and not conceding any ground if at all possible on a day like today, and it'd probably be the same until beyond the weekend, really, beyond Napoli perhaps.
Tough start for everyone, tough start for us, first day for us, but we sort of hit the ground, I wouldn't say running,
well,
we hit the ground at a brisk kind of...
You dropped me on the way to the start, Daniel. I was looking around at some of the statues and the monuments, and that you'd gone, and you were off to have a chin wag.
I was. The chin wag of the day makes its return in this Giro d'Italia, and it features today a gentleman who, with whom, those who listen to our pre-Giro, Kilometre Zero, the Land of Eagles, will be familiar with. He is none other than Mehdin Malhani. He is the Albanian national coach. He starred in that podcast. He's also the coach of Club Tirana. He's ridden races like the European Championships himself for Albania. And Nini, as I call him, was at the start today with his team of Albanian riders, Albanian national team riders, and they were riding ahead of the race today, as we're about to hear. So, Mehdin Malhani is the subject, the star of our first chin wag of the day, Chiacchierata del Giorno.
La chiacchierata del giorno. The chin wag of the day.
Well, I'm with someone who's already become a bit of a cult figure on the cycling podcast because nearly everyone. Everyone who listened to your story was intrigued by it and intrigued by Bene's story. But first of all, let's get something right. I refer to you as Nini. What is your actual name?
My normal name is Mehdin and surname Malhani, but all the friends call me Nini and everyone know me about the name Nini.
We've been struggling with the Albanian language. Give us, just before we start, give us three simple pronunciation lessons. How do you say hello? Përshëndetje.
Përshëndetje. So hello is përshëndetje, opure mirdita. Mirdita, that means in the middle of the day to present with the people. So that means, okay, mirdita.
And thank you.
Faleminderit.
Okay, these are the most important things. So you've had a very intensive few days, haven't you? Because you've done a lot of interviews. You're the national coach. You're the coach of Tirana Club. You're one of Albania's best cyclists. Just tell me about the last few days.
Never in my life I have this strange, let's call strange situation, because we are not adapted to be in television from morning to afternoon. So every television in Albania wants to know something about this biggest event. Normally in the world it's one event that is a big show. Everyone, every kids know about that. But in Albania, a little bit, the tradition is a little bit low. For tradition exists because we are in 100 year Tour of Albania, but after the year 19, people not think too much about cycling and about cycling culture. In Albania, people now think too much to buy a beautiful car or to make some money or to have a house, and second hand is sport or maybe third hand. But we are trying too much and we are pushing too much the youngs and the kids to be in this sport, because normally I enjoy it is too much, and it's a sport that you can do your soul, and it's a sport that you can hurt your heart during your training, during the race, during the all the day that you are involved in this.
A few weeks ago when we spoke, you were a bit worried about the fact that the Giro was coming and that the organization, they seem to be speaking a lot to the Ministry of Tourism, not so much the Federation. You worried about the impact that this Giro was or wasn't going to have on Albanian cycling. Are you a bit reassured?
It was a big surprise for us, because I have heard and I read some news about in the web, I mean, and I not trust myself that the Giro it will be there. Now we are in reality, and I am very surprised. I was also surprised, and I am again, because I don't know why it happened like this. We are the most important people in living in Albania about this sport, and we don't know anything about this sport. But okay, sometimes happen also like this, it doesn't matter. Important is to enjoy this and to profit much as we can about this. And that's all.
So RCS didn't really involve you as the national team, but today these guys and I'm, well, we're standing next to some of your riders, some of your national team riders. You are going to be taking part in a certain sense in the Giro. Tell us what's happening today.
We do just a demonstrative ride. We do the whole route that the pro, the World Tour rider, it will race. So the plan is to start 1 hour 30 minutes before of the best rider. It's just a demonstrative ride for marketing, to show all of the people that are fans that it will be in the road of Albania today, tomorrow, and also the Thursday, to see that we have also there a cyclist and we have a very good rider and very good, so every one of them can perform in perfect. Normally we have problem with investment. Yeah, it is the only one problem that Albania have in cycling culture, in cycling like a sport. Talent, we have it all the time. So I remember one time in 2017, one of our rider became third in the world championship in podium with Matt Pedersen and Matej van der Poel. So that means that we not miss the talent. We need investment, we need budget, we need more focus on that way than on the people that can be a cyclist.
Well, your guys are going to be setting off in a few minutes. They're congregating around us. Just a couple of things before you go. Today you're doing a climb and the race is doing a climb, the Grazen climb.
The first climb is Grazen, that is 13 kilometers.
And at the top, I believe there's a monument to the greatest Albanian cyclist of all time, the Fausto Coppi of Albanian cycling. How do you pronounce his name, first of all? Because I've been getting it wrong, probably. And tell us a little bit about him and the monument.
His name is Bilal Agaliu. It was 11 years champion of Albania. I think it's a long, long tradition, long, long story.
Yeah.
Imagine, 11 years champion, it was... I think it was an Ironman.
This was in the 50s and 60s, wasn't it? And just last thing, talking about Iron Men, we're not joined today by our kind of mutual friend now, Bene, who is in Greece. This is so typical of Bene and his story. Those who listen to the podcast this week will know that his story is a little bit unusual. And it's kind of unusual that he's been in Albania for 5 years, but today he's lost in the Greek mountains somewhere.
I told to him to be faster, not like before, because it was with me some time on training and it is a little bit slower. So I told him, be faster and at minimal catch the third stage at Vlora, at Logara. We will see what happens.
Okay. Well, Benny, you have a great... Sorry, Benny. Nini, you have a great day. I hope all your guys have a great day. And I guess we'll see you again tomorrow in Tirana and over the weekend.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Also for you, thank you so much that you are there in Tirana.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle. With ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Well, Lionel, we're deep into part three now, and I haven't even asked you the most important question of the day, probably the most important question of the day that I wanted to ask you at the start of today's episode, but didn't. Where the bloody hell are we?
Well, we're right outside the National Stadium of Albania, which is the Arena Kombëtare, which means National Arena. And this stadium, quite a new stadium, was started in 2016, opened in 2019, and it hosted the Europa Conference League final 3 years ago when Roma, Italian club of course, beat Feyenoord in the final there. And Daniel, in your pre-Giro Kilometre Zero with Professor John Foote, you talked about Albania's complicated relationship and history with Italy, and in a way this stadium really tells that story, and it doesn't get much more complicated than this. Now, if you look behind you, Daniel, there's a very modern stadium above us, but you can see this white brickwork here. Now, that's the original stadium that was built in 1939. Now, Benito Mussolini's Italy invaded Albania in April 1939, and they set about rapidly developing the whole city of Tirana, and an Italian architect from Florence called Gerardo Bosio, commissioned by the Italian fascist government, designed a lot of the buildings here in the rationalist style, which is this very blocky style of buildings, square shapes, a lot of marble used, or a pale coloured stone where they couldn't afford too much marble. Anyway, work on this stadium began in August 1939, just a few weeks before World War II began and started spreading across Europe. The first stone on the original stadium was laid by Benito Mussolini's son-in-law, who was the Italian foreign minister, Galeazzo Ciano. Because of the war, it took 4 years to finish the stadium, and in the war period, the Germans invaded Albania, Italy capitulated in 1943, and it wasn't until Albania was kind of liberated that the Albanians finished off the stadium. They only used marble on one side rather than four as planned, because they didn't have the money to finish it. But when the stadium finally opened in 1946, it was named after an Albanian hero, Kemal Staffa, one of the founder members of the Albanian Communist Party. He was assassinated by the Italian fascists who were occupying. He was killed on the outskirts of Tirana on May the 5th, 1941. May the 5th, which was last Monday, is a national holiday here in Albania. It's called Martyrs Day, and it recognises everyone who lost their lives fighting the Italian fascists. So the stadium was conceived by fascists, designed by fascists, and then named after a communist. And, I mean, I think that said a lot about Albania, Italy. The square over there is called Plaza Italia in Italian. I mean, but so there's whole links of with Italy here. There's also links with a British comedian called Norman Wisdom.
Oh no, but Lionel, we don't I don't want to talk. We'll get to that tomorrow.
No, it's really important.
It's not important. We don't want to hear about that. It is, you know, when I said to someone I was preparing something on Albania before the Giro, they said, "Oh, it's not the Norman Wisdom stuff. Everyone knows about that. Don't do that.
Let the listeners be the judge of that."
No, we're not that podcast. We're not the Norman Wisdom podcast. Interesting. Well, that was a lovely postcard. I think we should have another postcard from someone else in just a moment. But just on that subject, I'm attempting to give, not listeners, but people who follow me on Strava, a postcard of sorts, something that I come up with on spur of the moment calling it the Capitolo del Cappellino. Basically, I'm wearing a different cycling cap to run in every day. And on Strava, I'm trying to tell a story that links the cap to the Giro d'Italia. However, genius over here didn't realize that Strava videos are maximum 30 seconds. Today's entry was 1 minute 10, so I had to split it into three parts. I don't know what I'm going to do with this. I might abort this feature. I'm going to persevere with it. I might carry on splitting up the clips, but we will see. It was about Bradley McGee and La Française des Jeux in 2004 today. But, Lionel, let's have... they're not going to be daily dispatch, but they're certainly going to be very regular dispatches from another of our men here at the Giro d'Italia. It's our infiltrator in the peloton. It's Lucky Larry Warbass, the Motown maestro, who is here for Tudor Pro Cycling.
L'Aranzando, Larry Warbass's postcard from Italy.
Larry Warbass, a fan favourite already in here in the mix zone. An American gentleman, I think, was just calling out your name.
Actually, he's Serbian, but he worked in American cycling for a really long time. Yeah.
What's his name?
Honestly, I'm blanking on his name at the moment. I have to look it up after. But, yeah, I don't know. He had a lot to do with American cycling for a really long time. But anyway.
We'll look it up and do the work for you. Larry, first impressions of Albania. You, of course, have been here before.
I have, yeah. I came here for a weekend getaway with my girlfriend 2 years ago. So we stayed in Tirana, drove around. We did visit Durres one afternoon. And yeah, it was pretty cool place.
The last couple of days, I mean.
The last couple of days, it's interesting because then you see the real countryside when you go on some bike rides, you know. Yeah, I will say the road quality is not 110% on the roads that we were riding on, but I think today we're on some bigger, nicer roads, so I think it'll be good. But yeah, it's a cool place. We had a nice hotel, and unfortunately it's not like we're really getting out of the hotel so much. So we tried to go for a walk the other day, but we only got about 500 meters down the beach before we ran into a fence that said no trespassing. So
I tried to coax you out last night with a picture of my bottle of wine. I thought you might, because we're staying quite close to you, but alas, you're on curfew.
Yeah, you know, got to get ready. Today's a big day, so.
Larry, I will let you go in a second, but you've got a new watch, of course. Presumably the other one is safely stowed away for me to gift me at the end of the season.
Yeah. Maybe I should loan it out to Daniel Freiba for 3 weeks. I don't know. It looked good.
And Larry, just on the roads, you mentioned the roads. You, of course, are a dog lover. You have a dog. I've heard a couple of people express concerns about dogs maybe on the course today. I mean, this is something that you might not, well, you won't be able to legislate for, is it? Did you see any of that on your rides?
I mean, I saw some dogs on the beach coming up to say hello, but not on our rides. We didn't really run in. Some kids ran into the road to try to, I don't know what they were doing one day, but yeah, no.
Podcast listeners.
It's, huh?
Probably podcast listeners.
They were just so excited to see me, you know. No, I mean, it's a possibility. You know, there are a decent amount of stray dogs here. But I can't say that was a concern of mine going into today, but maybe it should be now. I don't know.
Last question, important question. How is Storachar?
Storachar. I was thinking we should rename him like Storizard or something, you know, give him his own name. But he's going well. Yeah, I think he's feeling good. And I think he's ready. So we'll see today. But I think, yeah, we'll know more after today, I think. But I think he's good.
Watch out, world.
Watch out, world.
So, Lionel, good to catch up with Larry. I think you caught up with him at the finish as well.
Yeah, he recommended going to see the Cold War communist era bunker, which is not far from here. It's kind of the other side of the stadium. So I'm going to see if I can find that tomorrow, probably while the time trial's going on.
I'll do you a deal. I will gladly swap whatever content you get from there with the planned feature on Norman Wisdom.
Oh, we're only going to do 12, 15, 20 minutes on Norman Wisdom. Don't worry.
Oh, my God. Lionel, it's time to talk about tomorrow's stage.
La tappa di domani, la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Yesterday's dinner. I'm not sure how authentically Albanian it was. I like to think it was pretty Albanian. There were a couple of specialities, certainly the cheese, but you can probably explain it, describe it in more detail.
Well, what do we have? We had a sort of an assortment of things to start with, didn't we? We had two types of goat cheese. We had a white goat cheese and a yellow goat cheese. One was in breadcrumbs, the other was in sesame seeds. It was
deep
very
fried.
Pleasant. Deep fried, yeah, very pleasant enough. And then we had some truffle dip and a, what was the other dip? That was a cheese dip of some description, wasn't it? And then a sort of tomato
ragu,
yeah. That was fine. I had the Albanian sausages, I guess. One was goat sausage, one was a beef sausage. Yeah, perfectly. They were nice. They were very dense sausages. Their double-cooked potatoes were basically just kind of oven chips. I mean, yeah, they lost marks for that for me.
I had some wild boar. I'm defaulting on my vegetarianism at Giro d'Italia, as I have done in previous years, because it's quite difficult on the road to avoid meat. I actually wanted to eat goat, but they had run out of goat yesterday, so maybe we will fare better today. Tonight we're in Tirana, scene of the venue for the time trial. Tomorrow we're going to talk about that now, in fact, in the company of another of our team here at the Giro d'Italia, Michele Pellacci, our new Italian, our young, very promising, very, very promising Italian signing at this Giro d'Italia. He's going to make his debut in just a few seconds when I bring up the page in Il Garibaldi about tomorrow's time trial. Michele has been riding over the last couple of days in Albania, so he knows a lot about the conditions of the roads. I don't know if he can bring much insight about the time trial itself tomorrow, because I don't think he's ridden the course, but I'm going to ask him. Let me just, Michele, just hold your horses. I'm going to 13.7 kilometers tomorrow, the time trial in Tirana. This is significant, chaps, because there's a good reference point. Pedersen versus Van Aert. Montluçon, let me take you back to Montluçon in 2022. Paris-Nice, stage 4. Wout Van Aert wins over 13.4 kilometers. Mads Pedersen is ninth, 25 seconds down on Mads Pedersen. More on that maybe in just a second. Michele Pellacci, say first of all, buonasera to the listeners. Introduce yourself quickly.
Ciao a tutti. Had some great chofta last night as well, which is a mixture of Albanian polpette and salsiccia.
Meatballs. You have to speak in English on the English podcast.
You're right. I have to get used to it. But had great yogurt as well. It was a bit... How do you say it when it's... it sort of gets your...
Fizzy.
And...
effervescente.
Picante, exactly.
And spicy. Fizzy and spicy yogurt. This sounds extraordinary. We're going to have to try this. Michele, just tell us quickly. You've been riding over the last few days, including with the Albanian national team, who I talked about earlier. How have you found the roads and how have you found cycling in Albania?
The roads are pretty okay around Tirana, but just around Tirana. Once you get outside, they ride in the highway, really, in the emergency line, they run there, the cycling team, normally, which is absurd for standards of, you know, modern cycling, but riding in the highway, in the tangenziale as well, is something,
not ideal.
Pretty dangerous, but roads are pretty wide and dusty, and tonight, the weather says heavy rain, so dusty roads, plus the rain, plus tiles on the finish line.
Tiles
as
ceramics, really?
Yeah.
Are there on the finish line?
No ceramics. How do you say? Autobloccanti or San Pietrini.
It's cobble. They're kind of cobblestones, big cobblestones.
Exactly. So it will be twisty and turny, and there will be a lot of slow points in tomorrow's time trial. So I expect some mistakes and surprises.
Wow, that sounds scary. That
sounds like our Giro, Daniel. Mistakes and surprises.
Yeah. I was worried today about the stray dogs. I mentioned them in the interview with Larry, or the Laranzando, because we have been surrounded by sort of Armani and Rolex clad, I hope I'm not going to offend any of them here, cyclist agents in our hotel in Durres. And the whole of the agent population of professional cycling seem to be staying in the same hotel as us. Very well healed, very well dressed, much, much better healed than us. And we were talking to a few of them over the last 24 hours, and a couple of them had expressed their fears, their worries about stray dogs on the course. But I don't think there was anything of that nature today.
No, I just think that a great comic movie starring Norman Wisdom, five cycling agents all living in a Durres hotel, doing their deals, talking about the future of cycling and taking their cut, I guess. That's what they do, isn't it, agents? They represent their clients' best interest to the very best of their ability for a fee.
Indeed. The time trial tomorrow, we've talked about Pedersen versus Van Aert. I'm pretty sure that Josh Tarling came to this Giro d'Italia with his eyes very much on that time trial and a stage win there. Do we have any hot tips, chaps, for who is going to take tomorrow's time trial? There's a climb in the middle. Pellacci, you don't know the climb?
I probably did it vice versa, but it's not really a climb. It's
like a railway bridge.
Yeah, realize you're up there.
Probably be more challenging for the GC riders who don't want to lose time. A day where it's important not to lose anything. Very few gains to be made, I suspect, other than just maintaining position.
Ayuso has a very good record in short time trials. I think in his career, I'd actually prepared this for the... for the preview a couple of days ago, just looking back at the time trials that he's done very well in the past, and there have been a lot of short ones in there, so I expect him to do well. But of course Roglic is a good time trialist. Since turning pro, Ayuso's TT wins have come over 25 kilometers, 10 kilometers, 15 kilometers and 18 kilometers, so he likes short time trial. Roglic has also liked short time trials in the past, like at the Basque Country last year. However, he has had a bit of a habit recently of starting time trials quite poorly, so that may not augur particularly well. But I don't expect there to be big big time gaps.
Lots of speculation here, Daniel. I think we should probably reflect on the time trial tomorrow when it has happened. We'll have a much clearer picture then.
Yes, we should. We should. I'll be very curious to see how Storachar, who we mentioned, Michael Stora, in our check-in with Larry, gets on tomorrow, because ordinarily he might be slightly concerned about a day like tomorrow. But we shall see. Lionel, we're going to head off into the night. Pelacci, you're going to, where are you staying tonight?
Downtown Tirana, going to have some beer, some more of this, which is really good. It's called
Corcha.
Corcha. I like that. So, a lot of them tonight.
Hopefully a lot
too
of many.
Them. Goodness
Jeepers.
Me.
You've only been on the cycling podcast a day, and you've already assimilated some of our worst habits. We're very modest drinking this year on the cycling podcast. Anyway, we will be back tomorrow in Tirana, from Tirana. Good evening, Lionel.
Thank you, Daniel.
Buonasera, Michele.
Ciao, a domani.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.